Good evening. So I feel a bit small behind this podium, but anyway, I'll just draw myself up to my full height. So the new society, 40 years on, the vision, the lessons learned, and the challenge today. That, I believe, is the overall title of the seminar. Yeah. I noticed neither of the two previous speakers actually mentioned that, so I thought I would. actually, I think Damarati might have. So I thought I'd start a bit biographically, although in fact Damarati rather, if I may use the expression, stole my thunder this morning, because he started his talk exactly as I was planning to start my talk, which was with me finding the FWBO. So he mentioned it because of the poster that he had done. So I'm going to go back a bit pre-poster, if I may. And before I really start, I'd just like to say that, just to warn you really, that this talk is mainly a string of quotations from the early Sangha Raksha with some comments in between them. So bear with me with that. So let's go back to pre the poster. So 1977, I'm in Glasgow. I'm extremely young, of course, in 1977. And my life is in an absolute mess. So there's been various threads to bring me to this point, most of which are in tatters by this point in my life. There's the kind of family strand. And by this point, everybody in my family except my mother has died, which is my father, grandparents, aunt, cousin, number of other cousins, number of friends. So in a very short space of time, I'd had a huge number of pretty major bereavements. And there was only my mother left. By this point in 1977, my dad had been dead for about a year and a half, and my mother had attempted suicide 5 times in that year and a half. So it was not the best of times for me, you might say. I had also just split up from, I was slightly embarrassed saying this to the people that know me now, I had just split up from a marriage. I had, in fact, been married for a very short space of time to a man. And, well, you never know, although actually 1977, because I'd be unlikely to be married actually to anybody else, would I? So, yeah, that had kind of fallen apart in a rather messy way. And I was really not in a very good state. I was probably, in retrospect, having a nervous breakdown, I suspect. I was doing a lot of drinking, drugs and rock and roll. I had been in the music business for a while by that point. But the other major strand that had brought me to this point in my life was politics. I had been extraordinarily involved in politics. I started in the Young Communist League as a 13-year-old. And then moved slightly further left as time went on. So I was one of those people that sold newspapers at the corner of streets and harangued people. I know there's a few others in this room who shared that background. So I was one of those people that thought you could change the world by shouting at people. And I thought you could bring about a culture of non-violence by haranguing people. And looking back, I can see that, in retrospect, I was part of the problem rather than part of the solution, but I did not have that level of self-awareness at 25. So I'd got very disillusioned, actually, by politics and had kind of realised that, in fact, although I was very idealistic and although I really wanted to change the world, and that had started quite young, actually, I realised I was really not in a position to do that. And I read Eric Fromm somewhere around that time, although it might have been slightly later, where he talks about the need to change the individual before you can change society. And this was quite a major realisation for me. I've said this before, but sometimes it's worth repeating things. I couldn't even change my library books at that period of my life, let alone change the world, you know. I constantly was running after myself, so things were always a bit overdue and a bit behind themselves. And I had got very disillusioned with the political kind of world that I had moved in. So I kind of realised that people had great ideas, and I still think some of the ideas and some of the kind of political analyses that I came across both in communism and in anarchism, where anarchy were quite kind of intellectually stimulating and quite interesting and even quite exciting and possibly creative. However, most of the people that I met did not fall under any of those categories, and it was quite a messy sort of world, so I was quite disillusioned. And at this point in 1977, October 1977, I thought I was pregnant, which just put the icing on the cake of the terrible state that I was in. So I went alone to a pregnancy advisory service and sat in the little room waiting for 15 minutes for the verdict. And I really felt like I was waiting for a verdict. I felt it was a life sentence. Because although I was, you know, not for religious reasons at all, but I knew I just wouldn't have an abortion if I had been pregnant. I knew I wouldn't personally be able to do that. But I also knew I really wasn't in any fit state to be a parent, and I'd never wanted to be a mother anyway, so I really was in quite a state waiting there, you know, to get these results. Kind of, what's going to happen? I was a Catholic before that. Anyway, the woman came back and said to me, "I'm terribly sorry, but you're not pregnant." Oh, yes! Yes! And I thought, okay, I must change my life. Like, take this as a wake-up call. Change your life. So I walked downstairs and out of this pregnancy advisory service, and there on the wall in front of me was the very poster that Damarati mentioned in his talk this morning. And what did it say? Change your life. So it was not only the picture of the crane that my daddy used to drive, it was also said change your life. So I thought, woo, 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 woo. There's obviously something in this. So I thought, I'll just find out what this is about. And it said on the poster underneath, Buddhism for today and tomorrow. And I did know a bit about Buddhism because I had previously on acid lay on a beach and had the Tibetan Book of the Dead read to me by some of my friends. So I'd already had an encounter with Buddhism. And I'd also had an encounter with Buddhism in the form of Malika, who some of you know, who was my drama teacher when I was 13. Not in school, but in an art centre that she ran. And she used to do things like stupa dances, which were very exciting. And in things like, we used to do quite a lot of stuff with mantra, so it's very exotic. So I'd come across Buddhism in different forms quite early, but they seemed to be quite alien, really. It didn't really seem to be anything much that I would kind of take to. My other encounter with Buddhism was going to a Zen meditation group, where I walked in and everybody sat and looked at a wall. Nobody spoke to each other. No idea what was happening. They rang a bell and then we all went home. I thought, no, I don't think meditation's for me, really. And I had another little encounter with Eastern mysticism in the form of Rajneesh, who also had a centre in Glasgow at that time. And I did Kundalini dancing a few times, which was very exciting. But it seemed to me that most people there were looking for a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and I was just trying to get out of it, so it really wasn't what I was after. So I kind of thought, Buddhism, I don't know, it's kind of... But anyway, I thought I'd go along and see what it was. So I rang up the centre, and the person that answered the phone was Ajita, who some of you knew, who was at that time the chairman of the Glasgow Buddhist Centre. And he said, just come up there now and have your dinner. So I'll translate that for those of you that are not Scottish speakers. He said, just come up now if you like and we'll give you your dinner. So I just went up to this Buddhist centre and these guys that I'd never seen before gave me a curry. I remember it well. And there was some very strange conversation going on, but I won't repeat it here in mixed company. And I listened to a taped lecture of a talk from Bhante called A Vision of Human Existence. So it was the very series, this was my first encounter with Buddhism, was the series of Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow. Now I actually missed the first one, which is why I was so sure this morning I corrected Damarati about the order of them, because I know I missed the one on personal development, because I've often thought it left a gap in my education. That I actually came in on the vision and the social change, and I missed the method of personal development. That's why I was so sure. Anyway, it was extraordinary, really, because it just felt like this man, this person I was listening to this lecture, Sangharakshita, was kind of just saying all these things that I had been trying to formulate. And it was an extraordinary experience. I mean, it was extraordinary for a number of reasons. One was that you had the most... put you to sleep. Soporific voice I'd ever heard. And I was really tired anyway, what with the tension, I think I might be pregnant and everything. So I was sitting there in this sort of room, very hot room, kind of going like this, you know, nodding off. But actually what he was saying was totally riveting. It was absolutely extraordinary experience. And I went along for those few weeks and heard the other talks. And given that my background had been wanting to change the world and realising that you couldn't change the world without changing yourself, I'd like to read you a quote from one of those talks. So this is the first quote on the bits of paper that some of you have. So this is from A Blueprint for a New World. The first view that we must change the system is generally regarded as the secular view. And the second, that we must change ourselves, is generally regarded as the spiritual view. Personally, I cannot agree with either view completely. In fact, they are not really mutually exclusive. Spiritual movements, especially those of Eastern origin, those who trace their descent from the wisdom of the East, are generally expected to adopt the second view. That is to say, the spiritual view, that we must change ourselves, improve ourselves, and everything will be all right. The world almost automatically will be a better, happier place. Bhante goes on to say, but the FWBO does not share this view, this so-called spiritual view. In the FWBO, we certainly are concerned with the development of the individual. We regard this as crucial, fundamental, even where the question of transforming the world into spiritual community is concerned. But at the same time, we do recognise that external conditions can and do help or hinder. He also talks in that series, and then in an earlier series, but I heard it later, Transforming of Self and World, he talks about the need to transform both self and society. And I just found that so extraordinarily inspiring. I just found it fantastic. It felt like everything that I'd been looking for, my political question, my religious, because I was a very devout little Catholic till I was about 13 or something. All that kind of searching for some meaning in life, even as a very young child, and meaning that actually was personal meaning, but also had some relevance for the world that we lived in, a world which even then, even as a kid, I knew to be an unjust, unfair, cruel world. So to find something, to find somebody speaking with such confidence and such conviction about the fact that the Dharma could not only change, not only be a method of personal development, but actually transform society was just... I just fell straight into it. I was ripe for it. I just walked straight into it at the right time. And I was really inspired by what we used to talk about of the three C's, which were mentioned both yesterday and today, this morning, in the afternoon question and answer session. There was quite a bit of talk. So the three C's, communities, co-ops and centres. I just thought it was amazing. It was like a whole vision of everything in your life, where you lived, who you lived with, where you worked, how you worked, and how you spread the Dharma. And it just seemed to me to be so relevant for the world that we lived in, that I was completely, I'm afraid I was also one of those gung-ho, completely obnoxious, very dedicated, focused people that Dhammarati mentioned this morning. And it was a bit like these four talks, the Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow, along with some other talks, became my manual for survival, really. And I went back to them again and again and again. But I think by the time I'd been involved in the movement for, 6 months or something, I had not only read all Bhante's books, which were only maybe about 4 or 5 at that time, I'd also listened to every single taped lecture that he'd done, which were quite a lot. and made notes and cross-referenced them and had a whole index system on them. And even the first night, I was there, Damirati wasn't actually in the class, but a bit later he opened the door and poked his head in, and I said, "Oh, I know you." And he said, "Yeah, I know you." We couldn't quite remember how we knew each other, although we did later. But that's another story. And I said, "Oh, your name's Ian, isn't it?" And he said, "No, it's Damirati." And I said, "Well, what kind of bleep name is that?" And he said, "Oh, it's a Buddhist name." And I said, "What does it mean?" And he said, "Delighting in the Dharma." So I said, "What's the Dharma?" So he basically gave me a Dharma course. He actually ended up walking me home at 3 o'clock in the morning, because I was just so full of questions. And he gave me the Three Jewels to read, which I took home and read in 2 days. And after that, I mailed Bhante a letter full of questions from the Three Jewels. When I look back, I think I was pretty precocious. But I think Bhante quite enjoyed it, so he answered them all. And I went to visit him, and he went through all my questions and told me all the answers, and which was great, really. So I really did throw myself in. I really wanted to live the vision. I was completely right for it. My mother died just quite shortly after I got involved in the movement. I started off November 1977, and in February 1977, my mother died 1 week, and the next week I became a Mitra and went off down to London a few months later to live in Amaravati, which was a big women's community. Well, they weren't big women necessarily, a big community of women in the East End of London. And that was that, really. I just threw myself completely in. I got ordained in October 1980, so took a bit longer than Damirati, I think. Actually, becoming a Mitra was quite fun then, but Damirati was talking about the difference in the kind of systems. So I'd been coming along to the centre for about 6 or 7 weeks or something, maybe a couple of months. And Ajita took me for a walk in Kelvin Grove Park and said, "Do you want to become a Mitra then?" And I said, "Nah, I don't think I fancy being a Mitra. I'd like to get ordained." And he said, "Well, you have to be a Mitra first." I said, "All right then." So he said, "Well, we'll do your ceremony on the 26th of February." I said, "Yeah, okay, sure, fine." He said, "Well, we're celebrating Parinirvana Day. That'll suit you. You've had a lot of death." Okay, fine. That suits me. And in fact, I say my mother died the week before, so it was definitely quite an apt moment to have a Mitra ceremony. I became a Mitra with Suvajra, for those of you that know Suvajra. We became Mitras together in the Glasgow Buddhist Center. Anyway, I decided I didn't mind giving you anecdotes and little stories and a bit of history, because I imagine that quite a few people here probably don't know that much about that particular period in the movement, so that's why I thought I'd give you lots of early Bhante. So let me share a few more quotes for you from early Bhante, because the talk, you know, the new society 40 years on, the vision. Well, I want to just share with you what that vision felt like for me as a 25-year-old coming in, you know, 26, late 20s, early 30s, kind of really getting involved in this community that was just at that point kind of starting to really expand. So when I was ordained, I was the 19th woman to get ordained into the Western Buddhist Order. So, and quite a few of them lived outside the UK. So I think there were about 13 of us in the UK. So it was pretty much thrown in at the deep end, because pretty much after I got ordained, in fact, I got ordained on a Sunday, and the following Friday I led the Friday night class at the LBC. And that was that, really. And I think I led my first Mitra study group about 2 weeks later or something in West London. So as Damirati was saying this morning, you do get a good training these days. It was pretty much learning it on the hoof when I got ordained. And I do know I made some pretty blooming mistakes. Some bloomers of mistakes. So anyway, I was enthusiastic. So let me share a few more quotes from the early Bhante that was my source of inspiration and the vision for the new society. So one of the talks that Bhante gave in the mid-70s was a talk called Evolution or Extinction, a Buddhist View of Current World Problems. So again, some of you know this talk quite well, I imagine. But I've quoted from it in other talks, and quite a lot of people had never come across it. So I really recommend listening to that talk. It's a great talk. It's reproduced in an edited form in What is the Sangha? It's kind of near the end of What is the Sangha. But the talk's actually fuller. There's more in the talk. Anyway, Bhante's talking about why he's given this talk. He's been asked by some friends to give a talk on the topic. And he starts off by saying, not necessarily a topic he would have thought of to talk about evolution or extinction. But however, when he starts to think about it, he realises actually it is quite an appropriate topic. So this is him talking about that. He says, "And I may say that I live this life, this Buddhist life, or try to live this Buddhist life, partly at least on account of the view which I take of the modern world and its problems. So therefore, in speaking tonight on this question of current world problems from a Buddhist point of view, I'm not in fact dealing with something which is to me of, as it were, academic or peripheral interest, or even just general interest. In a sense, I'm trying to make clear through the lecture, through the consideration of this topic, the sort of raison d'etre of my own existence, as it were, as a practical working Buddhist. Not just a Buddhist inwardly in faith and conviction, but so far as outward activities also are concerned. So for me, therefore, in view of these considerations, this lecture tonight represents a sort of almost, I may say, autobiography, at least a philosophical autobiography. It constitutes a sort of confession of faith, because it shows, or will show, I hope, where I stand, and perhaps to some extent why I stand there." So I think that's very interesting. This is 1977, and Bhante's basically saying what he says in so many other ways, that his raison d'etre for setting up a Buddhist movement is to transform society. So right from, you know, very early days, that's very much Bhante's take. But not just that that's why he's setting up a Buddhist movement, but that that's actually why he, as a practicing Buddhist, works as he does. I find it quite moving when he says it's a confession of faith. Something quite deeply touches me in that statement. And when I heard that talk and heard Bhante say that, it struck me so strongly, and I thought, this is my faith. This is my place to be. This is very much my... I didn't think this is my dharma, because in a way I didn't even really necessarily have that concept, but I very much knew that this was the path that I was going to tread for at least the rest of this lifetime. And actually, I have never wavered from that. I've had problems with the movement and the order sometimes, but I have never doubted the Three Jewels or my faith in the Three Jewels or my own willingness to commit myself to that and act to the best of my ability from that commitment. I've never ever doubted that since then, in the 1970s. So I think that's greatly to do with the way Bhante described the Dharma and the way I heard it. I was obviously very receptive and ready for the Dharma when I heard it, but I often wonder what it would have been like if I'd stumbled in some other way of approaching the Dharma. And of course, you never know. It's impossible to know. But I did feel there was such a fit between what I was looking for and what Bhante was offering. So the gift that Bhante was offering, I was absolutely ripe to take that gift. And I have nothing but gratitude for that. Anyway, I will come back to this lecture later, because in it Bhante makes some practical suggestions. And I think practical suggestions are good. But before that, I just want to also talk a little bit about my own experience of hearing Bhante give talks and of being on seminars with Bhante. So I was very lucky, actually, because I came along in the late 70s. Bhante was still giving series of lectures at that time. So I know some of you in this room were also at some of those lectures. I can remember that. The one that really, really stands out for me was the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. Listen to it if you get the chance, if you haven't heard it. Most of you probably will know it. But even listening to it, you just don't quite get the sense of what it was like being there in the East West Centre, an old street roundabout in London, Thursday nights, And it was just the most amazing experience. I really felt my consciousness being shifted. I kind of had this experience listening to Bhante sometimes that I left the room a different person. I mean, literally different from how I entered. And I read, I think it's in The History of My Going Forth, I think it might be. Bhante talks about the fact that he doesn't think he was any more in his prime when he was given his lectures in the FWBO. He thinks he peaked in India, and that although he's given good talks that he's pleased with, he feels that none of them were his peak, and that certainly later talks were not his peak. Although I'm not sure if I agree with that. I can think of some later talks that certainly had that experience. I had that experience of being lifted into another place, really another dimension. But the Vimalakirti and Adesha, if I had to choose one series, if I had to do my Desert Island Discs and choose one series of Bhante's lectures to take with me to the Desert Island, it would probably be the Vimalakirti and Adesha. And they're just magical, really magical. And Bhante was flying. He was absolutely flying during those lectures. He was just somewhere else. And I was really fortunate to be invited on a number of seminars. Bhante used to do these study seminars, and he did them a few times for the women. I think maybe he did about six or eight or something for women, and I was lucky enough to be on maybe five of those or something. And again, it was just this experience. You'd be sitting in a room. Again, I imagine some of you here had this experience, but you'd be sitting in a room listening to Bhante talking about a text. So, for example, one of them that I did with him was the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Virya and Kshanti from the Jewel Ornament. And he just would choose a text, we'd read a bit of the text, and then Bhante would just talk. And we'd have some interaction with questions and answers, but mainly he would just talk. And sometimes it would be quite tedious, if I'm honest. You know, sometimes, well, I would find it a little bit, you know. I mean, I do remember on one occasion listening to him talking about the curtains in Sukhavati, which was a men's community, and how they didn't have curtains that matched the bedding, which I really wasn't riveted by. But there were all sorts of things like that. But then just suddenly you'd just go, wow, you know, because he would just start to talk about something and it would just take off. And in my memory, those things are mainly about the bodhicitta. They're almost always Bhante talking about the bodhicitta, about the will to enlightenment, about the ideal of the bodhisattva ideal to practice not only for our own personal development, to practice for the sake of all living beings. And he would just talk about that, and we'd all just get absolutely transfixed. And then he'd say, perhaps now it's time for tea. And suddenly you'd just be back in this kind of Padmaloka, you know, this ordinary world. So I think I was just very lucky to have those experiences with Bhante. And and the bodhisattva ideal was always there. All the way for me, the bodhisattva ideal has been there. In fact, I didn't realise initially that that wasn't kind of like all of Buddhism, because the FWBO in Glasgow, that's what they taught. That's what we did. We listened to Bhante's bodhisattva ideal series. We listened to the tantric series. It was very, we were pretty Mahayana, I suppose. And we used to do pujas at midnight in the hills and things like that. Chant 108 Padmasambhava invocations at midnight and stuff like that. But very much and incredibly inspiring was Ajita comes to mind particularly, actually. And some of those, Dhanavira, Ajita, Damarati, just talking about the bodhisattva ideal in such a way that was completely convincing. I was completely convinced. Anyway, the bodhisattva ideal has been there all along. This vision of a new society is very much connected with the bodhisattva ideal. And the way Bhante's founded this order, the way this order works, is the outpouring, the expression of Bhante's bodhisattva ordination. I gave a talk once in America at some ordinations that Bhante did in Arialoka, and there were three of us giving a talk. It was Manjivadra, myself and Subhuti in that order. So I was sandwiched between Manjivadra and Subhuti. And Manjivadra talked about the significance of ordinations for America, I talked about the significance of ordination for the world, and Subhuti, of course, talked about the significance of ordination for the cosmos. And anyway, they were great. They were good talks, and they were recorded, except that the power went off just when I started and came on again just at the end. I decided not to take it personally, but there you go. Anyway, at the beginning of this talk, Subhanti was sitting there in the audience sort of thing, which... it's slightly daunting sometimes giving a talk with Banti in the audience. And at the beginning I said, well, at some point in the talk I said something like that our movement was an expression of the Bodhisattva ordination of Banti. And I kind of sneaked a look across to see what he was... and he was nodding his head, so I thought, oh, good, I must have got that right. And I asked him about it on another occasion afterwards, and he said, yeah, it very much was that for him. His Bodhisattva work was the founding of the order and the movement. So the Bodhisattva ideal's always been there, and it's always been there in our movement. I'm going to read you a little quote from the occasion of the first ordinations. So this is 1969, when Banti founded the order, and he ordained 12 people, including Ananda, who's still in the order all those years later. And he gave two talks. So this is from the second talk. So this is a quote, also in the sheet of quotes. Spanti says, in the second of my two lectures of the day on the Bodhisattva vow, I dealt with the Bodhisattva ideal. I referred to the fact that I had myself taken a Bodhisattva ordination from Dardo Rinpoche, whom I described as perhaps embodying the Bodhisattva ideal to a greater extent than any other person I had known. Everybody present should try to imbibe the Bodhisattva spirit and echo the Bodhisattva vow in their own hearts. So far as I remember, the main reason for my speaking on the Bodhisattva vow that day was that I wanted to emphasise the altruistic, other-regarding aspect of Buddhism and the Buddhist spiritual life. I was well aware that in the individualistic, self-regarding atmosphere of British Buddhism, the act of going for refuge, and therefore the ordination, was likely to be understood as possessing significance only for the person immediately concerned. It was almost as if, having not as yet established a direct connection between the arising of the will to enlightenment and the going for refuge, I at least wanted the Bodhisattva ideal to be around and ready to enter the situation as soon as the conditions permitted. So in the very founding of the order, Banti wanted the Bodhisattva ideal to be present. He wanted it to be there in our order. And it's still there, as Damarati mentioned this morning, explicitly at the point of ordination. We accept our ordination for the sake of all beings. So if anybody tells you we're not, you know, a Mahayana movement, well, we're not a Mahayana movement exclusively, because we do draw our inspiration from all strands of Buddhism. But the impetus behind the order and the impetus behind the setting up of our community is very definitely the Bodhisattva ideal. So order members, people in training for order members, people associated with the order to the extent that they feel they want to be, can consider themselves with some pride as trainee Bodhisattvas at the very least. So the order and the community is a mandala of individuals working together in different ways for the good of the world. I think that's a way we could describe our order. It's a network. It's a golden network of people associated only through friendship and trust, really, at the end of the day. So while the movement, the community, the FWBO, soon to be known as the Triratna Buddhist Community, although the movement has a legal structure and has centres, all of which have their own constitutions and their own way of working, the order itself has no legal entity whatsoever. There's no power structure within the order. Of course there is a structure, but there's nothing that holds that together in a legal sense. The order really is held together as a network of friendship and trust. And to the extent that that friendship and trust is real, then the order stays together. And where that friendship and trust becomes dented and challenged and even maybe broken at times, then the order is in a bit of a sorry state. Or at least the people who are in that relationship will find themselves in a not very happy place. So, yeah, what was I going to say about that? Yeah, even ordination, in a way, even the entering of the order is completely based on trust, because those of us who confer ordinations privately and publicly can only really do that because we have the trust of the order to a great extent, and we have the trust of Bhante and the people who have done that before us, done those ordinations before us. So partly I read that quote that includes Dardo Rinpoche because it seems to me that the fact that our order set up in a way is an expression of Bhante's Bodhisattva ordination, and he took that ordination with Dardo Rinpoche, says to me that I stand here in the lineage of Bodhisattvas, of Dardo Rinpoche and Sangharakshita. And that is what I try to, as a public preceptor particularly, try to hold that lineage and pass it on as faithfully as I possibly can to those that come after me. And as order convener, I suppose, I think I can speak for both Mahamati and myself, that we very seriously take our task of trying to keep that golden net of friendships as brightly shining as it possibly can. And where we find it burnished, where we find it a little bit tarnished, perhaps try and do our best to at least give the polish over and let people polish it for themselves. So in a way, I see my task as trying to keep alive that lineage of Bodhisattvas and trying to keep the order in the movement as faithful to that as is possible. I don't mean I keep it, because that sounds terribly, even a bit megalomaniac-like. I certainly don't think I can keep it anything, but to be part of that network, I see my task as really being embedded in that network of friends and in that network of trust, and trying to really keep the channels of that as open as possible so that information, friendship, Kalyanamitrata can freely flow between people, both individually and more in terms of chapters and regions, etc., etc. Anyway, this idea of the order as a network and the order and the community as a mandala of individuals coming together really, really inspires me. I love thinking of the order like that. It's like a dance. You know, we come together in all sorts of different contexts, and we come together in different formations, and it's a bit like a kind of, you know, one of those dances where you come together as an eightsome, and then you go off and two of those come together with another two over there somewhere, and somehow you actually are all connected, because in the small mandalas that each of us are part of, other people in that mandala are also part of other and bigger mandalas. And the order and the community really works like that. It's extraordinary, actually. It's extraordinary how, you know, one of the great privileges of my, well, it's not quite just as order convener, because I did it a bit before, but I have the great privilege of travelling around to lots of our centres, been to lots of different centres in the movement and the order. And it's extraordinary how I can walk in somewhere and just be accepted and welcomed as a friend. And that I know that I have so much in common with the people that I'm visiting there. And people that have never met me before will take me in and, you know, give me a home for a few weeks or whatever and be incredibly hospitable. But it's even more than that. It's something much deeper than that. I can go to somebody in Australia and sit in their house and pick up a conversation as though I've known this person, you know, for years and years and years, because we have a shared set of values, a shared set of practices, and a shared concern for our community. So this excites me. And at the nucleus of this new society, we have the order and the community. So I'm going to read another little quote from Bhante, which is from A Vision of Human Existence. So this was the very first talk I ever heard. And I really like this particular little paragraph of it. The Buddha's vision of human existence, therefore, represents a challenge. And those who take up this challenge will find themselves forming the nucleus of a new society. And it's with this new society, of course, that we shall be concerned in our lectures. Nowadays, there's a great deal of woolly thinking in the world. There are many different kinds of wrong view, And they all represent rationalisation in one way or another of a limited range of experience. That's actually quite an interesting sentence. I'll just read that to you again. I think this is really quite... I think it's Winabanti's insights, actually, is how wrong views and their emotional undercurrents and the kind of emotional counterpart of wrong view, how they meld together and how we need to work on both levels of that. Anyway, he says here... These views represent rationalisations in one way or another of a limited range of experience. So we all have a limited range of experience and we project from that. We tell ourselves stories based on our own limited range of experience, and we make this sad mistake of thinking that this story is in fact reality. And all sorts of things follow from that. All sorts of things. We have the perception, and all sorts of stories arise. And on that story, and those stories, all sorts of things happen. Happens on a personal level, it happens on a national level, happens on an international level. People's perception, limited experience, gets pulled up and taken into a kind of generalisation, which then forms some kind of worldview, usually some sort of worldview which has us and them in it, some kind of worldview which has other pushed away, and all sorts of things come from that. Anyway, Banti goes on to say, what we need nowadays, perhaps more than anything else, is right view, perfect vision, the vision of the Buddha. Because if we have this vision, we can grow and develop. Without it, we may well perish. So a glimpse of this vision, at least, is one of the four things that the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order has to offer the modern man and the modern woman. So... it made it very clear to me very early that Buddhism had a kind of analysis, not only an analysis of behaviour, but an analysis of view. And I found that very challenging and quite exciting. And it's been my experience for the 30-odd years that I've been involved in the movement, that my views still continue to be challenged, of course, and I still continue to find myself coming up against things that come from my own very limited range of experience. So conditioning, the kind of conditioning that I've had comes up against the kind of conditioning that somebody else has had. And community is a wonderful way of actually tackling that and seeing that again and again. So it made it very clear that there's a need for clear views, for clarity and for wisdom. So this new society needs to be based on a true understanding of the Dharma. Excuse me. Actually heating up. So our order and community need to be based on a true understanding of the Dharma. To be a nucleus of this mandala, and for this mandala itself to be able to work within the world, we can only do that to the extent that the centre of the mandala holds. Otherwise, we spin off. On the other hand, we can't turn only inwards to look at the centre of the mandala. The mandala needs to also look outwards. Banti says somewhere, I can't remember where, something like a spiritual community that doesn't look outwards will die. He says it very clearly in a number of places. So as a spiritual community, we need to be building the depth that holds the centre of the mandala. Whether that mandala is the mandala of your personal practice, the mandala of your centre, your community, your chapter, or whether it's the mandala of the order and the movement in general, the centre needs to hold. Without the centre, everything disperses. But neither can it be held so rigidly that there isn't room and space for creative movement in the mandala. So in terms of this nucleus, Banti says... and it's the nucleus, at least, of a new society that the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order offers. The nucleus of which the order is the central and essential part. It offers itself not as an organisation, but as a spiritual community. A community of individuals committed to personal development by themselves and in association with others similarly committed. And he says, this is from A Nucleus of a New Society, so this is still from Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow. And I really like this last bit. He says, it offers itself as an open community. That is to say, a community willing to welcome into spiritual fellowship all those who want to grow and develop. So we're an open community. And that's important, because if we're not an open community, again, it dies. We need to be open to the world around us, open to what comes in, and also open to allowing what we have to go out. There's a lot I could say about that, actually, and I have on other occasions, but I won't today. So Damarati talked this morning quite a lot about the order as spiritual community of individuals and community. I won't say much. The one thing I did want to say is that people sometimes talk about the order. You know, sometimes people, when they're in training to join the order, and I have to say, quite often once they're in the order, people often say, oh, it's fantastic being in the order, it really supports my practice. And I think, good. But I don't think that's the point of the order myself. I think it's great that the order provides a context for support for one's practice, but I think it's slightly missing the point to see it like that. I think the order is the practice. That actually being in the order is the practice. So of course it supports our personal practice. If we think of our personal practice as meditation, study, etc., of course we need to have an individual practice. And that is supported by friends and the good life. But actually I think the point of the order is the order is the practice. Maybe that's enough. Creating this network and keeping the network alive and vibrant because of the friendship and trust is in itself the practice. And I do believe that creating community is a radical practice. I think it's also what the world needs. So I'm going to go back now to the talk, Evolutionary Extinction, which I mentioned, given somewhere in the mid-70s. So in this, Bhante actually suggests four things that we can do in response to current world problems. He says, first of all, find a method of personal development. He says, secondly, join a spiritual community. And I think he says in the lecture, if you can't find one to join, create one. Thirdly, withdraw energy from all anti-spiritual forces and groups. And fourthly, where you cannot withdraw, influence. They're great. It's a manifesto for radical transformation. So just looking very briefly at each of them, personal development. Well, of course, that needs to be the centre, because we do need to be working on ourselves. As I said at the beginning of this ramble, you know, when I came along, I realised, in retrospect, I can realise that I was part of the problem rather than part of a solution. And that was because I didn't really have a way of working on myself. You know, I was a mess. And I didn't really have any sort of methodology to kind of get to grips with some of that. I was a very angry person, actually. I had a lot of anger, which I think I'm lucky that I found a context in which I could put that anger to good use and kind of transform it into something passionate. You know, there was passion in my anger. So finding a method of personal development so that we're not becoming part of the problem, but we're actually able to be part of the solution on a personal basis. And then join a spiritual community. Now, this is partly because that spiritual community will allow us a proper context, an adequate context in which to have that spirit, that personal development. So Bhante talks in this talk in terms of the true individual. I don't know if it's the first time he actually outlines that, the true individual, the group and the spiritual community, but he does talk about that in this talk. And he talks about how forming spiritual community will really encourage those values of the true individual, and that it's very hard to be a true individual when you're in the group, is how he talks about it. So he talks about finding other people who'll share your ethical values, who'll share your way of living, who'll share your desire to further yourself and to even transcend yourself. But also the forming of community in itself, he says, is a radical solution to the world's problems. So I'm not going to say very much about that, but I really suggest that if we're really thinking about creating a new society, we think about that. Why is it that the creation of community, and Bantry doesn't necessarily mean live in residential communities, but to really have a community, why is that such a radical alternative? And I'll leave you to sort of think, there's lots of answers to that. I'm sure you can all come up with lots of them. And then I really like the withdraw from all anti-spiritual forces. So in the talk, he talks about looking at the groups that you're part of and seeing where they do or don't encourage your nascent individuality. And where they don't encourage it, get the heck out of it. I'm paraphrasing slightly. But, you know, just get away if it isn't encouraging your individuality. And then he says, the fourth one, there are going to be some groups that you actually cannot get away from. He talks about the family, for example. Although some of us tried very hard to get away from our families, at the end of the day, you don't quite do it, do you? You kind of almost have to go back at some point, even if you've tried to get away. But anyway, there's things like the family, maybe work situations that you're in that you don't have the kind of luxury to choose to leave. All sorts of groups that we need to be in, society itself, you know, the sort of civil society that we're in. Well, Bantry says if you can't withdraw from it, make sure you influence it. And he talks a lot about speaking out. He talks about speaking out where we see injustice, speaking out where we see the need for transformation, and actually influencing. And we can do that in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes we can do it quite explicitly, and sometimes we can do it just by our own way of being. And people just see that, and that itself in itself will have an effect. So I do believe that these four suggestions are still pretty valid for the world today. In fact, I'd argue that the world needs it more than ever. So enough on the vision. I don't know when I started. It can be a short pudger. So lessons that we might have learned within our community. Well, Damarati mentioned zeal and harshness this morning, and I would agree with that. I do think that at times in the early days of our community, I'll speak for myself, my enthusiasm overran my kindness. I think that would be a fair way to put it. I was incredibly enthusiastic. I had a lot of energy. You know, I think I really did have a lot of energy. In fact, I think I was probably bordering on manic. And I really couldn't understand why everybody didn't work the same as I did. And I had no qualms about telling them so. So I really was not very pleasant, I think. And I have apologised to some people over the years for that. But I think it was also part of the culture. We had a lot to do. We had a movement to build, you know. We had centres to build and communities to run and right livelihood co-ops to set up and, you know. So I think there were damages and casualties sometimes along the way. I don't think ever done out of maliciousness, but almost certainly done through insensitivity. So I think there's lessons that we have learned from that, and Damarati did talk a bit about that. Another thing is I think we've learned over the years to really be true friends to each other. When I think back to my early days and I think about some of the discourse that we had about friendship, I think it was quite idealistic, and I wonder if we really had the maturity to live up to it. I don't think I did. But I think over the years we've learned that. And in the question and answers today, I think Damarati mentioned, some of us have known each other for a seriously long time. I've known Damarati for something like 35 years. She's more than half my life, you know. We've worked closely together. In the Preceptors College that I'm a member of, almost everybody in that college I've known for 30 years. It's quite something, isn't it? And I think we have over those years learned how to coexist, how to let each other be to some extent, but also how to enter into each other's lives and challenge where necessary and encourage where necessary and hold and support where necessary. So I'm going to just share a couple of little things. Actually, I'll cut because I've got quite a lot still here, but just one thing from a letter from a friend of mine, Kuladarani, whose mother died quite recently. And this is a letter that she sent to some of her friends after the funeral. She's talking a little bit about the funeral. I won't read it all, but at the end she says, "To me, this is the effect of our order, reclaiming and continuing to build such positive culture. It is possible for life to be messy, difficult and imperfect, and that is its perfection. We are a force for good in the world. The thousand arms of the order held the funeral process today. I thank you. This reflection is a flower of my gratitude to you who held me and the order that holds us all and holds the world. Much love, Kulidarni." So I just was very touched by that. And I thought it did express rather beautifully what it feels like when you're in a difficult place and you know you've got the order there with you. I think we've learned to be that for each other. I've got a few others, but anyway, I'll pass on. And I think we've learned a lesson from really seeing transformation in our own lives and in the lives of our friends. You know, I can look at people. There's people here in this room. There's people sitting in the back row that I've known since the 1980s. And I see differences in them. I see what's still there in them. I see the sanskaras that they still work with. But I see them working with them. And I see things that have changed quite deeply and quite strongly. I hope they can look at me and say the same. And I think we can take confidence from that. The Dharma's working. You know, people, both Subhuti and Dhammarati, talked about this period of lack of confidence that the order and the community is going through. And in that, one of the things that's been questioned sometimes is, you know, do we in the order have the practices needed to gain insight? Yes, we do. I'm quite convinced of that. So I look at my friends and I see them. I see the insight. I don't know, I'm not going to say she's entered the stream and he's this and he's that. In a way, I don't even really think like that. I sometimes think it's a bit of a red herring, to be honest. But I do look at people and see them deeply transformed. I see them kinder, clearer. I see them more able to reach out to people. I see them more able to stand their own ground. All those things. I see transformation. I think we can also learn how to pass on the learning that we've done. I think that's something we don't do so well. And I think Nyanaketu brought that up this afternoon in the question and answers, talking about getting together and just sharing what we've learned about community building. And I think there's all sorts of things where we could really make a much more conscious effort to share our learnings. We've done really well in lots of ways. We're fantastic. Okay, we're not perfect. And I could stand up here and give you a whole great big long list of the imperfections. I could. I've spent a lot of time being told about them by certain people, and I've spent a lot of time seeing them for myself. But actually, I also think we're pretty damn good. We've got quite a few things right. Some mistakes, but I think we're doing all right. Wind Horse Evolution, I think you're doing great. You know, you've managed to hang on in there through, you know, really bad recession. You've had lots of challenges, but as far as I can see, looking at it from the outside, you've risen to those challenges and you're finding ways of turning that into practice. So, oh, there's all sorts of things, isn't there? The very fact that we have this network, some years ago I did quite a bit of work with Joanna Macy, who some of you will know or have read, come across. And I remember the first time I had a conversation with her, something like 99 or 2000 or something, and she was really excited to meet somebody from the Order. She'd met a couple of people before, but a long time ago. She was really excited because she thought that the Western Buddhist Order had the most fantastic infrastructure and were the closest to a kind of living system. You know, she's very big in system theory and talks quite a lot about what a healthy system is. And she thought we had the kind of infrastructure that would allow that to be the case. She was very, very impressed. She'd obviously followed our progress since the 80s and, you know, was really impressed by the fact that we still had right livelihood businesses and communities. I did have to tell her they were slightly waning in their, they weren't quite on the up at that particular point. But nevertheless, I did sit down and count up how many communities we still had because of the conversation I had with her. And there were still quite a lot of communities and quite a lot of people living together in all sorts of different combinations. Anyway, so there's other lessons, but I'm going to move on to the challenges so that I can draw to a close. So challenges, I thought of quite a lot of challenges actually, both internal and external. So I think one of the first challenges that I wanted to talk a little bit about is, it's kind of encapsulated, I think, in some ways, in our name that we are just moving away from, i.e. the Western Buddhist order. And I think it's encapsulated in the two words Western and Buddhist. And I think there's a challenge there because we are a Buddhist order which was set up in the westernised world. And most of our order members outside India are pretty westernised, although they might not, in fact, consider themselves Western. In fact, it turns out quite a lot of them don't consider themselves Western. But definitely living in a westernised culture, which means that we have all sorts of expectations about how to come together. So I don't have the time to expound this, and I'm slightly nervous about saying it and getting jumped on later. But anyway, I'll just say it. I sometimes think that the Western bit gives us a sense of the vertical, and the Buddhist bit is a bit of a sense of the horizontal is the Western, and the Buddhist is the vertical, if you see what I mean. So the Western horizontal brings all sorts of things in with it. Ideas like democracy, ideas like participation in decision-making and how that might happen. Certain ideas about how those things might happen. And then the fact that we're Buddhist brings within it another set of values. And I sometimes think there's a challenge in seeing how those two live together happily. So that we don't become strictly hierarchical, but neither do we only go for the horizontal, if you see what I mean. As I say, I'm sorry, that's slightly shorthand about something that I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about, and I'm trying to kind of grapple a bit with some ideas, but there's something in that. How do we create a way of having participation on the broadest possible level in our community, coexisting happily with a sense of an influence from people we experience and practice? And anyway, I think you know what I mean. So I think that's one challenge. And I'd like to read a little bit from a Shabda. I've had permission from the person who wrote it. It's from a Kupa who wrote a thread in the March Shabda, which I think what he says about this is actually very, very good. So if you'll be patient with me, because I know I'm overrunning my time. And it's just a little bit. He's talking about discipleship in this, and he says, there's been a lot of talk about discipleship. It's not a word I've found that comes naturally to the vocabulary of one steeped in democratic tradition. I've been thinking, though, about what drew me towards the FWBO and what keeps me here. From the outset, I loved the idea of being part of a band of friends who shared their deepest values. That's still the case. But that would never have been enough had I not also entered into relationships that were clearly of the teacher-disciple kind. That also is still the case. Does that make me in some respect immature? Is the role of disciple in some way demeaning or subservient, such that one needs to outgrow it as soon as possible? My actual experience says the opposite. Looking back, I've been at my best when I've been most strongly in the role of disciple. Every aspect of my practice, meditation, daily life, how I share the Dharma, has been at its richest and most satisfying when done under the guidance, near or far, of a teacher or teachers. Discipleship has never been a role I've stepped down into. It's one I've stepped up into. At its best, it's both demanding and ennobling. I found that very interesting and quite moving when I read it last month. And I think he really encapsulates something there. I think he really encapsulates something about the need to be open to the influence in that kind of relationship. But also, you know, we do need to have those kind of structures that allow us to come together and participate so that people do feel that they really are part of something. Anyway, quickly, some more challenges. I'm just going to throw them at you. I'm not going to say very much about them. I think we're about to, at some point in the next few years, we'll face the transition from Bante to no Bante. Hopefully it'll be quite a while yet. Hopefully it'll be, you know, another who knows how many years. I sincerely hope it's quite a long time, but probably at some time in, you know, the life of most of us, we will be in an order that doesn't have Bantu there anymore. And I think that brings all sorts of challenges. I'll just leave you to work them out for yourself, I think. Again, it's something I've thought quite a lot about, but it's maybe another talk. I think there's a challenge in bringing along a new generation. Now, by that, I don't only mean young people coming into centres, which we talked a bit about this afternoon. I also mean bringing along the next generation of people taking responsibility. A couple of years ago, I was at a meeting of the European Buddhist Union, and we talked about Sangha building. And we got together in groups to talk about different things. And actually, there was a group which was something like learning from mistakes. And everybody wanted to be in that group, so we all ended up just having a big group. But one of the things we talked about was this, that most of the people in that meeting are people who are senior teachers from different traditions. Well, actually, it was at a Buddhist teachers meeting rather than the European Buddhist meeting. They're all teachers, quite high senior teachers in their own traditions. And they're all in their 50s, or maybe their 60s. And they've all been practicing since the 60s or the 70s. And they all of them said that they haven't managed to find the right way of bringing on the next generation. And it's a really interesting problem, and I think it's something that we really need to look at. There's still too few of us holding too many responsibilities. So it's a real challenge to know how to share them out in a way that sort of works. Okay, another challenge, I think, is to deal with conflict and polarisation when it comes up. And I think that partly relates to the size as we get bigger. The fact that we're getting bigger brings all sorts of challenges, actually. It brings challenges to do with, we're a global network, as the title of this talk says. And that's true. We have order members and friends and mitras in every continent, as far as I know. And, there's a lot of language groups there. There's a lot of different cultures there. There's a lot of different ways of living there. So I think that brings a challenge. The challenge in that for me, there's a number of challenges. One is diversity and unity. How do we have that? How do we create the conditions that are absolutely appropriate in each situation while still being unified and having something that holds us together? Also, how do we maintain internationality and worry about climate change? That's something I think about. As somebody that takes planes a lot and goes to foreign parts, I think quite a lot about that. Also, in terms of size, I think, it's something that I've mentioned before, how do we open up and hold the centre? They're all kind of like quite related challenges, I think. So some years ago, Subhuti talked about opening up the movement and deepening the order. And I think we did quite well at opening up the movement. I'm not so sure we really managed to do quite as well as maybe we could in deepening the order. I think maybe there's work to do in that. But I think both those, the centrifugal and the centripetal, have to happen at the same time. And they both need to be given attention. So how do we do that? How do we have depth and breadth as an order and as a community? And then there's external challenges. We live in a changing world. I think we face the same problems that we faced in the 60s and 70s when Bantu was first talking about the new society. But I think they're bigger. The scale is even bigger. David Loy, who some of you might have read, talks about the institutionalisation of greed, hatred and delusion. And, I think we can see that, can't we? And I think the challenge that brings is how to not feel helpless and powerless in the face of something like that. And I think Bantu's 4 points about personal development, community, withdrawal and influence are still very relevant, even in the face of institutionalised greed, hatred and delusion. And I think there's another challenge to be found in our relationships with alternative groups, allies. I think it's very important to find allies in society. And I think it's very important that our communication with those allies is firmly rooted in our dharmic practice so that we know what we bring to that alliance. But I think the most basic challenge is really the same as it's always been. I think the most basic challenge we face, and we face it with all those other challenges, what to do when Banti's not here, how to be Western, how to be Buddhist, how to be broad, how to be deep. The biggest challenge that all of those other challenges are subsumed by is how to be a healthy, truly spiritual community. That is really the challenge. How to be that network of friends? How can that network be truly gold, truly forged in gold? So, Banti talks about this in a talk he gave in 1999 called Looking Ahead a Little Way, which, again, if you haven't listened to this talk, I really recommend it. It was the talk that he gave, at an order convention. It's a talk in which he said that by the following year on his birthday, he hoped to have handed on his responsibilities as head of the order. He did not say he was handing them over, as he's made the point a number of times. He was handing them on. There is, in fact, a difference. Banti's very clear in the words that he uses. Had he handed it over, he would have left himself with no authority. He did not do that. He handed them on. He shared them. So, anyway, in that talk, he talks about what happens when a number of people are really forming a truly spiritual community. And he says that a stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy will start to manifest. So he talks about the bodhicitta. He says if we're truly a spiritual community, then that force of bodhicitta will be present within us. And that is what we need. We need the bodhicitta at the centre of our mandala. That is what will hold our mandala together. That is what will give depth and strength and centrality to our mandala, is the bodhicitta. And Banti said it will arise in community. What does that actually mean for us? How do we create the kind of community in which the bodhicitta can be alive? Well, I've sometimes said in talks, you know, I really want to create a community where the bodhicitta can arise. When I was in Bodh Gaya last February at the Order Convention, I had this stunning realisation, was that I'm in a community in which the bodhicitta has arisen. It's here. It's what founded the Order. It was Banti's experience of bodhicitta that founded our Order. When I say I want to create a community where that can arise, what I really mean is I want to create a community to serve that. I want to create a community in which I too can be open to that. And all of us can actually have that experience for ourselves and together. So what now, to conclude? Well, I'll ask you to please refuel the idea of the new society, to really work on the principles that will make that society truly new, the principles of non-violence, generosity, simplicity, truth, and clarity of awareness, the five precepts that we already have and we already work with. Share them where we can. And I'll ask us all to learn the Dharma, to find within ourselves Dhamma Chanda, thirst for the Dharma. Find the passion that drives you. Find where that passion meets the Dharma. Banti translates Dhamma Chandra somewhere as being crazy for wisdom. Be crazy for wisdom. Because it's what the world needs. Because wisdom, when it's there, crazy or otherwise, will give rise to compassion. Be a light in the darkness. The world needs it. In the Gandavyuha Sutta, we're told that just as millions of lamps can be lit from one lamp, without that one lamp being diminished, from the one lamp of aspiration of all the Buddha, from the one lamp of aspiration, the lamps of aspiration of all the Buddhas are lit, and yet that one lamp is not exhausted, it shines undiminished. So however much we can serve that light, however much we can fan the flame of the candle in the lamp, this is our challenge. Our challenge is to be a nucleus. Our challenge is to support the bodhicitta. Our challenge is to have a nucleus that interacts with society. I'll finish with a poem of Banti's. It's a poem called The Four Gifts. And in this poem, he talks about exactly the same things as he talks about in the Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow lectures. He says, I come to you with four gifts. The first gift is a lotus flower. Do you understand? My second gift is a golden net. Can you recognise it? My third gift is a shepherd's round dance. Do your feet know how to dance? My fourth gift is a garden planted in a wilderness. Could you work there? I come to you with four gifts. Dare you accept them? Thank you.